Now we're holding on page 10 in Psachim, the paragraph labeled Daf Chof Vov Amud Aleph, so middle of Os Yud Aleph. After the Gemara deals with the whole thing about Isurei Hana and everything that we had excerpts of before, then the Gemara gets into a question: what if you have something that is also Hana, but you're not having Kavana to have Hana from it? Maybe you could avoid it, maybe you couldn't. So, for example, various kinds of intangible hana. So the Gemara goes through some discussion about that, and then in the middle of it mentions this the piece that we have over here. Amar Rav Shimon ben Pazi, Amar Rav Yishuv ben Levi, Mishum bar Kapara, koil, a sound. For example, if you hear the sound of the musical instruments in the Beis Hamikdash. Now, to use the musical instruments themselves, if a person uses them for his own purposes, that would be me'ila. He'd be committing the aveda me'ila. B'mezid, he'd get malchus, b'shogeg, he'd be bringing a korban osham and paying back hekdesh for it. But here, he just hears the sound of them. Umare, or if he sees, for example, the beauty of the building of the Beis Hamikdash, the reyach, or the fragrance, for example, of the Torahs, ein behem mishum me'ila, then me'ila does not apply to them on a daraisa level because they're intangible. So the Gemara goes on to discuss, or the on the face of it seems from that they're also derabanan, and how does that fit in with this whole thing of love of loy kamachaven? On the face of it, you can't avoid hearing this and so forth. And so the Gemara has a whole discussion about it, including also the question: are there times when smelling the Torahs would be also daraisa? And the Gemara ends up distinguishing between before the Torahs has been burnt, before the mitzvah has been done with it, versus afterwards. Ben Yehoyada points out that these three things reflect the three kinds of enjoyment that the neshamas have in Gan Eden and Lo'asid Lavo, the hearing of course, the sight, and the fragrance of Gan Eden. And therefore, so we're saying over here, all of these are intangible things. And in this world, a person may, there's a limitations on what a person can enjoy of them, but Lo'asid Lavo, there won't be. Okay. Further on in the Perek, the Gemara deals with the question: how was still? I mean, the main topic of the Perek is supposed to be Biur Chometz, after all. So the question is, what method can you use for Biur Chometz? So in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda says the only valid method for Biur Chometz is to burn it. The Chum say no. You have other methods you could use instead. You could crumble it and scatter it to the wind, and then or other examples like that. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about why Rabbi Yehuda holds the way he does and why the Chacham hold the way they do. So in the course of it, sort of Yehuda is trying to prove his point. So at one point he argues to them based on a certain din in Kodshim. And the Chachamim respond back to him and they tell him, you know what, that might work according to our opinion in that particular din, but your own opinion in that din is that those posel of Kodshim are to be buried. So how are you now using it as a proof to say that they should be burnt? So here's where we pick up in Ein Yaakov, Shosek Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda was quiet and didn't have an answer to that. With that said, some Mefoshim point out, doesn't mean that Rabbi Yehuda changed his mind. He has other arguments that the Gemara was bringing to uphold his opinion. He was trying to argue based on this, the Chachamim should agree with him, and they're saying, but on the other hand, you're contradicting yourself. But as far as his own opinion, he still holds by it, Ein Biur Chometz Ela Sreifa. And in fact, there are Rishonim who paskin that way, although the majority don't. And in Shulchan Aruch, it's brought, Lamaisa, we do burn it whenever possible, because that is the best way to do it. Nevertheless, though, we have, you are Yotze, Biur Chometz if you do it other ways, and in particular when Erev Pesach comes out on Shabbos, then we use other methods, as we know. So Amar Rabbi Yosef, so Rabbi Yosef says, so look what happened over here. Rabbi Yehuda was slugged up by his very own words. Hainu de Amri Inshi, this is like the expression people say, Kapa de Chota Nagra, the spoon that the carpenter carved out. Begave nisroif, with that very spoon, he's nisroif, which was he's nisroif mustard. Rashi says two possibilities of yisroif. One is it means to burn, Milosh and Soraf. So it means with that very spoon, he ends up burning his tongue and his mouth on the spicy mustard that he ends up having to eat out of the spoon. Rashi says a second explanation, the word Yisroif, we also find in some places in Shas, can mean to gulp down. So he ends up gulping down or swallowing down mustard out of that spoon. So in other words, it's like a popular expression when a person ends up getting it in English, you have an expression, the person is voiced by his own petard. So you have sometimes that a person, the very thing that a person created, that itself is what comes back and then boomerangs on him. Omer Abaya, 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 Omer, it says on the bottom. Bias says, here's another metaphor to illustrate the same idea. Nagra, or sadhana, nagra would mean in general a carpenter. Sadhana specifically means a carpenter who makes foot blocks. Foot blocks, or they're also called stocks, that were punishment they had in those days. They would take the prisoner and they'd chain up his feet in a wooden block so he can't move. And also while he's sitting over there immobile, people could throw rotten vegetables at him or who knows what else. It was a form of punishment they had in those days. As you even find it, Rashi mentions there's a pasuk in Iyov where Iyov complains. He says, Hashem, the way you're treating me with everything you've done to me, like you're putting me in the stocks and watching every step I take and ready to bring down the hammer on me. Anyway, so sadhana, but sadhana Yosef, when that maker of the stocks himself ends up sitting in the very same stocks he made, meaning Rashi says, when he's found to be a thief and he's sentenced to this punishment, midvil yode mishtalim, he gets paid back from what he himself lifted up his hands, meaning the very work that he did, is what now becomes his instrument of punishment. Similarly, Rav Amar, Gira B'Girei Michtil, when the arrow maker gets killed by his own arrows, Midvil Yedei Mishtalim, he gets paid back by the work of his own hands. So these are all popular mishalim that people would use for this idea that a person creates something which eventually itself harms him. Ben Yehoyada points out, so why do we need three different mishalim? He says, because we're talking about the context is over here. We're talking about a Talmud Chacham who was shlugged up. Now, when you think of it, there are three ways where you can be shlugged up. There can be where you have two statements of his that it's very difficult to reconcile. So that would be compared to the spoon with the mustard. You can eat mustard. It is edible, but it's hard to swallow. So the same way, how you would reconcile those two might be hard to swallow, but is doable. The second one, compared to the stocks, would be where he's shlugged up because of something else that he said, which clearly contradicts the second thing, but the previous statement was based on his own svara. So therefore, okay, so you have two things. He's obviously contradicting himself, but after all, we might eventually show that, you know what, that first svara was flawed and the second statement that he made is correct. So that's compared to a prisoner. Right now, he's in jail, but eventually he may get out of it. The third one is where his second statement is contradicted by a first one that he said, where that first one is based on some earlier unimpeachable source, a pasuk or a mishnah or what have you, where there's no getting around that. Then it's like the arrow maker killed by his own arrows, there's no coming back from that. It's Yosef brings over here from the Vilna Gaon that also they're referring to the various things that a neshama may go through after 120. Rabbi Yosef mentioning being burnt by sharp mustard is referring to the burning of Gehenna that a person might have to undergo. Abayu, who compares him to a prisoner, is referring to Gilgal, where the neshama has to be imprisoned in a body again. And Rava is talking about that the person ends up dying. So all three of those, each one is meted out, midah keneged midah, tailored to what the person did. Further on in the Perek, the Mishnah talks about various dinim. If you have a business deal with a goy, if you have a loan, for example, involving a goy backed by chometz as a mashkin. So you have various dinim over there. If the chometz belongs to the Jew and the goy is holding it as a mashkin, or vice versa, when it's chometz shavur al haPesach, if the loan is still outstanding after Pesach, when not, so the Gemara goes through a whole sugya of a couple of blot on it. So one thing the Gemara points out in that regard is this piece over here, that sometimes the one who's holding onto a mashkin has a certain degree of ownership over it. How do we know that the Baal Chayv, the one who's owed the money, who's holding on to the mashkin, how do we know that he acquires the mashkin? Now Rashi learns that it means, therefore he acquires it to the extent that if there were to be an onus, if there were to be some unavoidable accident that causes the mashkin to get damaged or destroyed or whatever, then he would be responsible for paying for it, or rather what we would do is we would deduct that from the amount of money he's owed. On the other hand, Tosfos and a number of other Rishonim disagree with Rashi on that and say that no, it means he's no more than a Shomer Sachar. It doesn't mean he fully owns it. It just means that he owns it as far as certain purposes in halacha. For example, that he can use it for uh, to, to, he can use it to be makna other things with. There's something that you have, for example, you can use it for chalifin, let's say, where you need to have his keli to be able to use it, so you could use it for that purpose, but not that he actually owns it to the degree of unsin. Anyway, how do we know that? Rabbi Yitzchok says, Shenema, the Pasuk tells us, now you have in two places in the Torah, it talks about the din, that if you have a mashkin from a poor person, and he needs it on a daily or nightly basis, then you have to return it to him every day or every night. If it's something that he needs by day, then you need to return it to him every morning. And if it's something he needs by night, then you need to return it to him every evening. And the Pasuk says, Ulcha tiyeh tzedakah. When you do this, it will be considered for you as tzedakah. So, im ein akoyna mashkin, if the Baal Choyv doesn't acquire the mashkin in the first place, tzedakah minayin. How can we call that tzedakah? You can call it gemilas chesed, you can call it whatever. Tzedakah suggests that you're giving away something of your own. Mikan la Baal Choyv shekoyna mashkin. Thus we see that the Baal Choyv actually acquires the mashkin, and the Torah is still telling him to return it, to return it every day. One thing is, you have in Kuntras in Yonashal Torah Sachsidus, that Eber talks about at some length over there, the concept behind saying Moida Ani, and the concept of the Neshama going up as Pekodin to Hashem every night, and then Hashem returns it in the morning, and analyzing it according to Pshat, and Remez, and Drush, and Soid, and showing how Chassidus illuminates each of those. So one thing that comes into that is this point, that you have to return the Mashkin every day, in the same way Hashem acts the same way and returns the Neshama, the Mashkin, every day, even though he would have every right to keep it, because he would have every right to keep it, but he doesn't. He gives it back. In fact, Abona points out over here that also. So you might have. Think about it. When you have a mashkin, means on the face of it, maybe that deducts from the mitzvah that you did of lending to the guy. After all, the mashkin means you're more certain of getting payment back. But no, Fakert, we're saying that you end up with an extra mitzvah of tzedakah for the fact that don't think that it takes away from the mitzvah, adrabe, it augments. You took the mashkin to protect yourself, but nevertheless, you still have the mitzvah of tzedakah every time you're returning it to him. Tosfos, by the way, discusses the question. We really, when you get down to it, there are two kinds of mashkin. You have the kind that you take to begin with when the loan is taken out. You tell the person, I want you to give me something as security for the loan, versus you have where later on the guy doesn't pay up and you go and take something from his. Or actually, the pasuk says you can't take it directly. You have the shliach beis din goes and the person has to bring him out something, whatever. So Tosfos deals with the question, which kind of mashkin are we dealing with over here? So that's the Torah doesn't say it's not taken in the middle of the loan. The Torah says you can't take a mashkin from an almona, v'leisachla begin almona, where you have a machlokas with Shimon and the Chachamim about the parameters of that. No, in general, the Torah says you can take a mashkin, but you can't go into the guy's house to take it. Bachutz tamud, you have to stand outside, and the guy who owes you money, Yotzi Alecha, will bring out to you something that he'll use as a mashkin. And it can't be you yourself, it's the shliach based in whatever the Gemara deals with all those dinim and Rav Matzia. We didn't take it at the beginning, right? Okay. Further on, the Gemara talks about another din involving chametz. Suppose you have truma of chametz. Now, it being chametz, you have to get rid of it on Pesach. On the other hand, it being truma, then you have dinim of truma, including that a zor is not allowed to eat it. So what would happen if a zor were to eat truma, that's chametz, would he be liable for payment? Normally, when a zor eats truma, b'shogeg, he has to pay an equal amount of the same produce, and it becomes truma. Does that apply when it's chametz? So the Gemara goes through a long sugya on the subject, and one thing the Gemara ends up distinguishing is, did this chametz ever have shasa kosher? Was there ever a time when it was truma, but not yet chametz? Or was there, by the time it became truma, it was already chametz? Let me say it a little differently. Was there a time from when it could have been made truma where it was not yet chametz, or from the time that it could have been made truma, it was already chametz? So the Gemara says, in that case, the only way it seems that you could have that would be as if it became chametz while it's still attached to the ground. Now, you would think, how does grain attached to the ground become chametz? But the answer is, once it's completely ripe and it's dried out, then it can conceivably become chametz even while it's on the stalk. In the Friedrich Rebbe has the famous description of how they used to harvest the wheat for the Shmura Matzis in Lubavitch. They would go to there was a chosid over there in Shabina, Reb Zalman Shabina, and they would go and then harvest the grain from him and so forth. And he describes the whole maimed. Anyway, he mentions that one of the conditions was that it had to be that there hadn't rained for 3 days beforehand. Related to this, because the grain is already ripe. If it rained any time in the last couple of days, it could become chametz without you realizing it. Whereas if it's already a couple of days, if anything did become chametz on the stalk, you would notice it, and then you would know not to. Then you would notice it to throw that one out. Anyway, so the Gemara asks, "Achmas betolosh hochinami de koncha." So are you telling me then that? So are you telling me that if the grain became that only if the grain became chametz while it was still on the stalk, where then you can't even designate it as truma yet, so then it would never become kaddish in the first place, because by the time you designate it as truma, it was already chometz and was also on Pesach. Whereas achmetz betolush, if it became chometz after it was already picked, as grain normally does, hachinami de kodsha, you're going to tell me that it does become kaddish, that it is chal, the name of truma on it. So in that case, it would come out that something the Gemara had discussed earlier would only be referring to this very rare case where achmetz b'mechubar, where it became chometz while it's attached to the ground. Why would it be talking about such a rare case? Omalei, so Reb Nachman, I think it is, says to the one who's asking, ain, yes, as a matter of fact, and he quotes a Loshon HaPosek, b'gzeiras irin pisgama. This statement is according to the verdict of irin. Irin literally means the awake ones. In the Posek, it refers to the Malachim. And in the context of the Posek, it's talking about in one of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, where Daniel tells him, this gzeira that's going to be for you, that you're going to end up becoming like an animal, has been decided and the verdict has been settled by the Malachim, and you have no way of getting around it. Anyway, but here, Reb Nachman is using the word irin to refer to the Tamer Chachamim, who are compared to Malachim. So b'gzeiras irin pisgama, the statement is according to the verdict of the awake ones, meaning the chachamim, umeimer kadishin she'elta, and continuing with that Lashon HaPosek from Daniel, by the word of the holy ones is the discussion. And indeed, they paskin in the Beis Medrash, like me, that is the case, that is indeed the only case where it wouldn't become truma in the first place when it became chametz while it was still attached to the ground. So even though it may be an unusual case, but yes, that is the case that it's talking about. The Pashtos, the Ein Yaakov, put this piece in here because of this expression over here that we're pointing out, that Talmid Chachamim are compared to Malachim and holy ones. So you should realize, he writes in his Akdama that one of the things he gathered together, the things in Ein Yaakov, among other things that teach us about to honor the Torah and those who teach it. So therefore, this is a suitable thing for that. Look, further on in the parak, it starts talking about what kinds of grains can you use for matzah. The halacha is, of course, you can only use the chameshas aminim. The Gemara mentions over there a couple of other opinions that are not accepted, the halacha, that you could use other ones as well. So then it goes through several blot dealing with many of the dinim of baking matzah. And so the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, lechem oini, when it says that the matzah has to be lechem oini, poor man's bread, prak lecholot ula ashisha. That comes to exclude cholut, which is where you put the flour first into boiling water to blanch it, so that way it comes out much whiter than usual flour. So that kind of thing is not something that poor people do. Tosfos, by the way, deals with, and a bunch of other Rishonim deal with, there are various Gemaras on the subject of cholut, some of which imply that you could use it for matzah, others imply that it's not even considered bread. Here we're saying it is, but it's not lachamoni, and Tosfos and a bunch of other Rishonim deal with reconciling those in various ways. Was it boiled in water versus other juices? Was it boiled and afterwards baked? Different kinds of things like that. Anyway. Velashisha, it also excludes, you can't use for matzah, and ashisha, which Rashi describes, means gluska gdola, a very large loaf. Now, the Gemara will explain soon what the size of an ashisha is, but in Shulchan Aruch, because of that, it mentions that therefore you should be careful not to make the matzahs too big, because then it'll be like an ashisha, it'll be like a very choshava kind of bread, and that's not lechem oni. continues the Braise, well, on the other hand, if it's called Lechem Oni, maybe you can only use Pas Hadra, which it actually translates as like pumpernickel or something. Maybe you have to have, it's full of bran and everything else. Different other Mephoshim talk about another possibility of Hadra may mean grain that was chewed on by bugs or something, which is like all a poor person can afford. Nope, because the pasuk says several times the word matzos, which comes to include Rafilika matzos shel Shloima. You could even have matzos of the quality that Shloima Melech had. You can imagine Shloima Melech's matzos were made of the very best quality flour. Im kein matam loima lechem oni, well, then what does lechem oni exclude? Like we said, prap lecholo to lashisha. So, in other words, the flour itself can be the highest quality flour, and the baking can be done under the cleanest conditions, but you can't have that the flour is, that you have something done to this flour, like cholot, to make it that it's different than normal flour, or that it's an ashisha, that it's an extra large loaf. Both of those things are already not lechem oni. So cholot means scalding, technically. It means that you take the flour, you dunk it in boiling water to blanch it. Makes it like you bleach it like that. You make it extra white, and then you take it out from that, and you knead it as usual. But that already wouldn't be considered lechem oni, we're saying. So the Gemara says, "My mashma dahai ashisha lishna." B'chlal, the Gemara, by the way, deals with throughout the sugya about the possibility of doing that b'chlal of blanching flour like that and then using it. Fine, you can't use it for matzah mitzvah. On the face of it, you could use it for other matzah that you're going to eat during Pesach. However, the Rambam already brings that the Gaonim said, "Don't do that because what if the water is not boiling 100%, then you're going to end up with chametz." So therefore, the universal minhag developed not to do such things on Pesach. Anyway, umay mashma dahay ashisha lishna dechashivosahu. Where do you see that the word ashisha refers to a very important, a large loaf of bread? So dichtiv, you have in the pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, you have the story over there. It's the haftarah for Shmini, where the Aron is being brought to Yerushalayim, and David is jumping and dancing and making an enormous simcha of it, and they bring korbanos all over the place. And then the pasuk continues by Chalek l'cholam. David HaMelech gave out to all the people, to all the multitudes of Jews who were assembled over there. Every person he gave. Among other things, he gave v'eshbar echad v'ashisha achas. He gave each person over there one eshbar and one ashisha. So what are those things? Eshbar means achas mishisha b'par. The word eshbar is short for achas mishisha b'par, one-sixth of a cow. So in other words, a bull. They had been bringing many bulls as korbanos shlamim throughout the whole time when they're bringing the Aron from Kiryas Yearim to Yerushalayim. So can mention that the Gemara in Sota mentions a machlokas. Is it that every single step they're bringing a korban? Is it every six steps they're bringing a korban? Whatever it is, the point is they brought an enormous amount of korbanos. So now David HaMelech is giving out to each person who was there 1/6 of one of these korim that had been brought as a shlamim. And ashisha means achas mishisha be'efa. The ashisha would be 1/6 of an eifa. Now, an eifa is, so you have the omer asirasa eifahu, and omer is a shiur chala, where you have different opinions among the poskim what a shiur chala is, anywhere between approximately 3 and 5 pounds. So an eifa, therefore, would be somewhere between 30 and 50 pounds. So 1/6 of that would be between about five and 8 pounds. So you're talking a very chosh of a large loaf. Where do you get, Marashah says, fine, ashisha is easily enough Meloshin shisha, but where do you get an eifa specifically? Why not 1/6 of some other measure? And Marashah says, because we have the eifa is mentioned in many places in Tanakh, so therefore, so we can assume over here that the ashisha, if we understand that it's Meloshin shisha, Meloshin 1/6, we're going to assume it's 1/6 of an eifa. So that would be the kind of ashisha, therefore, that you can't have as matzah for Pesach. However, the Gemara says, "Pliga de Shmuel." Now, this understanding of ashisha disagrees with Shmuel's opinion. D'amar Shmuel, ashisha garba de chamra. Shmuel says that an ashisha means a barrel of wine. Dichtiv, as you have a pasuk in Hosea, where the Navi is criticizing people for indulging themselves in luxuries and not focusing on Torah and mitzvahs, and he tells them, "V'oyav ashisha anovim." They love ashisha of grapes. So therefore, we're meant to understand that means something choshuv made out of grapes, namely a barrel of wine. So therefore, according to that, it would mean that that would be what David gave out to everybody, the 1/6 of the power and a barrel of wine, plus the pasuk also says over there, chalas lechem. Marsha points out, not necessarily is Shmuel disagreeing with, now the Braisa had used that, clearly used the word ashisha to mean a large, to mean a large loaf of matzah. Shmuel is not necessarily disagreeing with that, Marsha says, but he would say, as the Gemara sometimes says, loshen Torah l'chud v'loshen chachamim l'chud. The Torah and the Loshen Torah and the Loshen Chachamim are different dialects of Loshen Kodesh, and not always does a word mean the same thing in both of them. So in Tanakh, Shmuel was saying the word Ashisha means a barrel of wine. In Loshen Chachamim, yes, it may have changed meaning and comes to mean a loaf of bread of the size of a sixth of an eighth. Further on, the next thing it talks about in the Perek is the is what kind of vegetables can you use for maror? So the Mishnah lists five different kinds. Omar Rava. So now the Gemara starts discussing the point that out of those five, chazeres, which is romaine lettuce, is the most preferable. So Omar Rava, my chazeres. Why my chazeres? Chasa. What is the name for it in Aramaic? Is called chasa. My chasa. Why is it called chasa? Or Marsha says the question is not why it's called chasa, that's its name in Aramaic, finish. The question is, what makes chasa more preferable for maror than any of the other species? And the reason is the chos rachmana ilavon, because it represents that Hashem chos, that Hashem had rachmanus on us and took us out of Mitzrayim. So according to Rashi, that the question is why we call it chasa, the point of the answer is, in other words, that's why it's called chasa, because it was created for, it's meant for that purpose to be used as murder, and that way we remember that Hashem had rachmanus on us. According to Marsha, it's just why is that the most preferable one? Why are the Mitzrayim compared to murder? By murder was chayeim. Loy malach, because it comes to tell you, ma chazeres or morozeh should chilose rach v'soipe kasha. It starts out soft and sweet even, and it ends up being very harsh. So lettuce in particular, when we take the romaine lettuce and we eat it on Pesach, you know, you always wonder how is this morozeh? It doesn't taste bitter at all. You put in a little horseradish in it, then you have a kick. But the chazeres itself, the point would be, in other words, yes, because they harvest it and sell it to us when it's young and soft and relatively sweet. But if you were to leave it to continue growing, eventually it would become hard and bitter. So that's similar to af mitzriim, trilosin raka, v'seif and kasha. With the mitzriim, first it was very gentle, and then it became very harsh, which means a few possibilities. Rashi mentions the point that at first they would actually pay the Jews for their work. Afterwards, they took that pay away and they started enslaving. Marsham mentions another point also, that in Soita, it mentions over there that they pretended we have a great public works project, even Pare is going to participate, every patriotic citizen of the country should come and join in, and then that's how they got the Jews into it, and then eventually they enslaved them. So the point is, it started out good, and eventually it became very harsh and bitter. Other Mephoshim point out also, you have to begin with, Pare invites them to settle the Erev Meta Ba'aretz Be'eretz Goshen, and then things deteriorated. So for all those reasons, therefore, Morer in general, and Chasa in particular, is very appropriate to remember all of that. By the way, in that connection, worth mentioning, you know, why is it that Shevet Levi was never enslaved in Mitzrayim? One interesting explanation is that when they made that announcement, everybody come and participate, even Pare is participating, the Levim said, we have more important things to do. Yaakov put us in charge of the Bate Medrash. We're not leaving that for any public works project. And once they hadn't come that first time, then Pare left them alone after that as well. Elu over in Perek Shlishi. The beginning of the Perek talks about various kinds of things that you might have around the house, various kinds of foods and cosmetics and glues and other things like that that contain chometz ingredients. So not only have to get rid of chometz be'ein, but also all these things that have chometz ingredients. The Mishnah lists only seven things that you might have around the house. You know, nowadays you have like Rabbi Blumenkrantz's book or whatever. You know, you've got hundreds of pages of them. That's, you know, there's modern conveniences for you. But anyway, one of the things it mentions in the Mishnah is chometz ha'adoim, vinegar from Edom. Now, vinegar in Gemara times was made almost exclusively from wine. So not a chametz about wine vinegar. The thing is, the Gemara explains that before this piece here in Ein Yaakov, that they would have to put barley and they'd have to soak barley in the wine in order to make it become sour and turn into vinegar. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, b'tchilak shoyim v'im nisachim miYehuda. Beforehand, when the Beis Hamikdash was standing, they would bring wine from Nesachim from the land of Yehuda. Therefore, in the schus of that, the wine from Yehuda was very good quality, and it would never go sour and turn into vinegar. Unless they put barley into it. So the term that people used for that kind of vinegar, they would just call it plain vinegar because it was a known thing. The only way you're going to get vinegar is to soak barley in it. So therefore, it was a known thing that kind of thing is has to be gotten rid of on Pesach. The Achshav, now that this mikdash has been destroyed, that bracha has been transferred from the Jewish people and instead gone to Edom. The wine of the Edomim, it might mean the people of Edom in the south of Eretz Yisrael, it might mean the Romans, either one. Their wine doesn't turn sour until they put barley into it. People don't call it plain vinegar anymore because nowadays, in other words, the point is, many times you'll have vinegar that comes just from wine in Yehuda, which turns sour. So chometz unspecified means now chometz from Yehuda, which has no chometz in it. It's just sour wine. When you want to talk about the chometz kind, you have to distinguish it and call it chometz ha'adoni. L'kayim mashanema, this fulfills what it says in the pasuk, where the Novi to Yechezkel talks about how the city of Tsur, Tyre, nowadays it's in Lebanon, but in those days it was an Edomi city, says on themselves, Imola hacharava, I will be filled up because of the destruction. This is, in other words, the Novi is saying that they're gloating over the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash this is talking about, and saying, now that Yerushalayim has been destroyed, then I'll be filled up, I'll become fuller because my rival Yerushalayim is gone. Which we learned from that, between Yerushalayim and Sur, when one of them is full, the other one is destroyed, and when the other one is full, then the first one is destroyed. So in other words, it can never be that both of them are up or both of them are down. It's always a balance. And therefore, so that was reflected in what happened with the wine over here, that when they had the schus of the Nesachim, then the wine of Yehuda wouldn't spoil easily, and the wine of Edom would, and now after the Churban, it's the other way around. Rav Nachman Yitzchak says we see the same point in the pasuk when Rivka is told of the two babies in your womb, one nation will prevail over the other, meaning that it was the same idea when Esav is strong, Yaakov is weak, and vice versa. You never have they're both up or both down at the same time. The Gemara in Megillah expresses that idea not about Sir but about another major Roman city in Eretz Yisrael called Kayseri. The Gemara says, by the expression, if they tell you your Shalayim and Kayseri are flourishing, don't believe them. If they tell you both of them are destroyed, don't believe them. But if they tell you one of them is flourishing and the other one's destroyed, then you can believe them because Elohim Elohim Yemot, it's always that balance between Tov and Ra in the world. Okay. At the end of the Perek, it talks about the case where a person is, suppose a person has left his house to go and do a dvar mitzvah, and then he remembers he has chometz at home. So under what conditions does he have to return home to burn the chometz, and under what conditions can he just be mevatel it and continue with what he's going on to? So that leads the Gemara into a short discussion over there, what kind of sudas are considered a sudas mitzvah and what are not. And then that leads the Gemara into the following piece of Agadah. Tanya, Rav Shimon Elazar Omer, kol suda she'en shel mitzvah, any suda that is not in connection with a mitzvah. And previously the Gemara explains that, for example, a suda of kiddushin, when a couple does kiddushin and they make a suda for that, where the equivalent of it nowadays would be a vert. So that would be a suda mitzvah. Would that be a sudas mitzvah? But when it's not a sudas mitzvah, ein tamad chacham rashoy lahonis mimena, a tamad chacham is not supposed to enjoy such a meal. Because a Talmud Chacham should be, even Yaakov brings from a Tosfos in Kiddushin, does it mean that he shouldn't do it, or does it mean that he's not allowed to? The idea being, in other words, a Talmud Chacham should hold himself higher than the general population. He shouldn't act in a way that degrades the covet of Talmud Chacham in front of others, and therefore he has no business being by Suda unless it's a Suda Shomitz. The Maharal makes the point also that a Talmid Chacham is supposed to be higher than Gashmius, because after all, he's learning the Ruchnius to Keturah, and therefore he has to be careful about getting himself too enmeshed in Gashmius. So the Gemara says, Kigoin Mai, what would be an example of a Suda which you would think is for a mitzvah, but we're saying is not? So Kigoin Bas Koyin Yisrael, for example, if a Bas Koyin is marrying a Yisrael. Now, really, in other words, Rashi says, the point is a Bas Koyin should really be marrying another Koyin. Like this, it degrades her family. It takes her down a peg by marrying a Yisrael, because Koyanim have greater Kedusha. So therefore, if a Bas Koyan is marrying a Yisrael, you can't call that a Suda Shel Mitzvah. Further on, the Gemara is going to talk about harsh things about when a Yisrael marrying a Koyan. With all of that said, the Tzemach Tzedek writes in one of his Truvas that maybe nowadays that doesn't apply so much. Because, for one thing, we don't have any Koyanim Yuchosim anymore. Nobody has an actual Ksav Yichus tracing them all the way back to a Koyan who served in the Bais Mikdash, which would be needed to establish them 100% unimpeachably as a Koyan. Every Koyan nowadays is only a Koyan Chazakah. He's a Koyan because he has a Chazakah, because his father told him he's a Koyan, and so on and so forth. So therefore, since Tzemach Tzedek says for that, and also the fact further on the Gemara is going to talk about, in particular, an Ame Oretz marrying a Bas Koyan is a very bad thing. We don't really have Ame Oretz of the type that the Gemara is going to talk about soon. So therefore, the Tzemach Tzedek says you can be a little make on it. You don't have to have that the guy is an outstanding Talmid Chacham. It's enough that he knows one Masechta. And based on that, is the Hurrah from that the Rebbe used to give Chassanim who were marrying a Bas Koyan that they should learn at least one Masechta Baal Peh. So people will learn Masechta Kala or some short Masechta like that, and that way they're Yotze what the Tzemach Tzedek is saying. What?
It's still a mitzvah to get married.
It's still a mitzvah to get married, but we're saying if it's not the kind of marriage that's appropriate, then it's not considered a Suda Shel Mitzvah. Ubas Talmid Chacham Lama Oretz. Another example would be if the daughter of a Talmid Chacham is marrying an Ame Oretz. D'amar Rabbi Yochanan, as in fact Rabbi Yochanan says, Bas Koyin LeYisrael Ubas Talmid Chacham Lama Oretz. If a Bas Koyin marries Yisrael, or if a daughter of a Talmid Chacham marries an Ame Oretz, Ein Zivrugan Ola Yofa, their marriage won't come out so good. Maihi, what do we mean? It's not going to come out so good. Amar Rav Chista, Oy Almana Oy Grusha Oy Zera Ein La. Like you have what the Pasuk mentions the case where Bas Yisrael marries Bas Koyan marries Yisrael, and the Pasuk describes over there how she's also to eat Truma, but then if she's widowed or divorced and has no children, then she's allowed to go back to eating Truma. So now he's using the similar expression. The Pasuk is like hinting at that's going to be one of those things that happen when a Bas Koyan marries a Zer, when she marries Yisrael. So either she'll be an Amona or a Grusha or Zera Einla. Marsha points out, now, that's what the Gemara is going to point out soon, that's only if he's not a Talmid Chacham. If he's a Talmid Chacham, a Yisrael marrying a Bas Koyan, then the Gemara is going to say soon that's fine, and the reason is because even though it's true she doesn't have eating Truma anymore, on the other hand, a Talmid Chacham, to a certain extent, is also called a Koyan. We find the Pasuk of Nei David Koyanim Hoyu, where it doesn't mean they were Koyanim, they're from Shevet Yehuda, but it means they were distinguished ministers in his government, but it also means they were Talmid Chachamim. So therefore we see Talmid Chachamim can be called Koyan. The Masnisatana, in a Braisa we learn, when Yisrael, who's not of the right caliber, marries a Bas Koyan, Oi Koivra, either he ends up burying her, in other words, she dies young, Oi Koivautoi, or she buries him because he dies young, Oi Mviatu, the Danios, or she brings him to become poor. So the Gemara asks, Eini, is that so? So you're telling me that a person can become poor, or Yisrael, from marrying a Bas Koyan? Well, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, on the contrary, Rabbi Yochanan says, if a person wants to become rich, Yidbak Bezare Shel Aaron, he should join himself to the descendants of Aaron, Kol Sheken Shetoro Kuhuna Ma'asharte, because on the contrary, you'll have the Torah plus the Kuhuna will make him rich. Meaning, Marsha says that, you have like this, the special avoda of the Kohenim is the Ketores. And the Gemara tells us in Yuma that the avoda of the Ketores made the Kohenim rich. For that reason, the Mishnah and the Gemara mention over there, in general, whenever possible, they would allow a Kohen to do that avoda only once in his life. When they made the girdle to determine which Kohen is going to do the Ketores, they would announce Chadoshim Ketores, only the ones who are new to it, who have never brought Ketores before, because they wanted to spread out the bracha as much as possible. Torah also involves a bracha of Osher B'smoyla Osher B'chavim. So therefore, so when you have those two together, then it's reinforced. And Mao Shah says, the Gemara assumed, fine, if it's not a Talmud Chacham, fine, you don't have that reinforcement, but at least you have the Osher from Kahuna. Shouldn't that at least count for something? Why for Kerut are we saying he becomes poor? And the answer is exactly that, like Kasha. Haba Talmud Chacham, haba Amoritz. Depends whether we're talking about a Talmud Chacham or an Amoritz. When it's a Talmud Chacham, then it's a good thing. As Mao Shah says, a Talmud Chacham is to a certain extent like a Kohen himself. So therefore, the Osher that he gets from his Torah and the Osher of the Kohenim reinforce each other, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan says he'll become rich from that. But if he's an Amoritz, then on the contrary, he's degrading the Bas Kohen by marrying her, and therefore he doesn't get the bracha of the Kohenim, the Osher, and on the contrary, he becomes poor. So the Gemara gives examples. Ki hodu Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Yeshua, Nosif Kahanta, Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Yeshua, married a Bas Kohen, Cholash, and then he became sick. Omar, so he says, apparently, apparently, Aaron doesn't like that I should join together with his descendants, that he should have a son-in-law like me. Now, obviously, whether it's Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Yeshua, he's certainly of Talmud Chacham, of caliber to be marrying a Bas Kohen, but he's saying, obviously, Min HaShemayim, they're showing I still have work to do. The itasi, and he was healed, in other words, to show Min HaShemayim that no, it's not so. He is fully deserving of being the husband of a Bas Kohen. Maybe he did tshuva. Similarly, Rabbi Idi Ba'oven married a Bas Kohen, v'havale tre b'nei smichi. He ended up having two sons who got smichi. So they might ask smichi, sakadadach. What do you mean they actually got smicha? Could be, Ion Yaakov brings from Sefer Yochsin, maybe by the time of Rabbi Idi Ba'oven, the real smicha, the original one, Ish Mipiyesh to Moshe Rabbeinu, back to Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe that had ceased to exist. Or maybe the Gemara means Rabbi Idi Ba'oven and his family lived in Bavel, and you can't give smicha in Bavel, it has to be in Eretz Yisrael. So how did they, what do you mean they had smicha? Ela imed chozu smicha, means they were capable, they were of the caliber to get smicha, if smicha still existed in their time, and if they were in a place to get it. Uman inun, who are these two sons? Rav Sheshes, Breder of Idi, Rav Yeshua, Breder of Idi, who are distinguished Amiroyim, who are mentioned in various places in Shas. So the Gemara finishes off this point about marrying a Bas Kohen. Omer Papa, Eloi Dinasivna Kahanta, Eloi Yatri. Rav Papa says, if I hadn't married a Bas Kohen, I wouldn't have become rich. We find in many places in Shas that Rav Papa was rich. In particular, he made his money brewing and selling beer, but he's attributing it to the fact that he married a Bas Kohen. Omer of Kahani, Loi Dinasivna Kahanta, Loi Galoi. If I hadn't, on the other hand, Rav Kahana says, if I hadn't married a Bas Kohen, I wouldn't have gone into Golos. Tosfos deals with the question, doesn't that means apparently Rav Kahana is not a Kohen? We find other Gemaras that imply that he were, so that he was. Tosfos says maybe not necessarily. It means his wife was a Bas Kohen, like we're saying over here. With that said, the other possibilities, there are many Rav Kahanas in Shas, some of them may have been Kohenim, some not. Anyway, the story that he went into Golos, the Gemara in Bava Kamma, tells the whole story. The Kitzur, he killed a Yid who was threatening to massacre on another Yid, and then the result was he had to escape from Bavel and move to Eretz Yisrael. So he says he attributed it to the fact that he married a Bas Kohen. Omer lo v'hol makom Torah Golisa. They said to him, what's the problem? He went to a makom Torah in Eretz Yisrael. He answers, lo galoi kedu golu inshi. True, but I didn't go into Golos to have it go to the makom Torah, the normal way that people do, where they go voluntarily. I had to because of that story with killing that Moses. So I attribute that to the fact that I married a Bas Kohen, in other words, and he's saying I wasn't worthy of doing so. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola, Chayalo. The pasuk says, "Vasiroisi es leiva even mibsarchem." I'll take away the stone heart from within your flesh. V'nasati lachem leiv baser, and I'll give you a heart of flesh, meaning that's more receptive to elikus. So they one time asked the Alter Rebbe, "Why are you talking about such high levels of ruchnius? What are we? How do we even relate to them?" And he answers to them about this pasuk with Yemosi Mashiach. What do you mean? The pasuk says you have a heart of stone. It doesn't say you have a mind of stone. A heart of stone is very hard to transform before Yemosi Mashiach, and therefore it's up to Mashiach to do it. But to prepare the brain, that we can do through our avodah in the time of Golos. So therefore, we're talking about these very high levels in Ruchnius in order to at least get rid of the stone brain and replace it with a Moyach HaBosel. Continuing with Halachas about Ma'ariv. If a person comes to shul for Ma'ariv and he finds the people and finds that Tzibur is already about to daven Shemana Esrei, and now it's already after Plag HaMincha or later, then he davens with them Shemana Esrei, and then later on he'll say Kriyishma with his brachas. If they're in the middle of Krishma or it's Brachas, if he's able to say the whole thing up till Shomer Esam Yisrael La'ad before they get to Shemana Esrei, then he should do that. In the Velt, they say Baruch Hashem La'olam, so in that case, he should skip it. With us, that's not relevant anyhow, because we anyway don't say it. If he hadn't davened Mincha yet, then he should daven the Shemana Esrei Mincha, the Mincha Shemana Esrei, while the Tzibur is saying Krishma with the Brachas, then wait a little bit, at least today, Hiluch Abamas, and then daven Shemana Esrei with the Tzibur for Ma'ariv, and then later on, he'll say Krishma with its Brachas for Ma'ariv. Because in general, as much as possible, you daven with the Tzibur, you daven Shemana Esrei with the Tzibur.